Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Zachariah Mampilly, Marx Endowed Chair of International Affairs at the Marx School of Public and International Affairs at CUNY, joins me to discuss the Western Left's blind spots when it comes to the continent of Africa, including its lack of coverage of the massive protests that were occupying Nigeria some 10 years ago.
And Heather Digby Parton will help us break down all the top news items of the week. Hey, you can support this program by becoming a member by going to ROFpodcast.com. When you do, you not only support this show, keep it alive, but you also get extra content. Today, an interview I did several weeks ago in the wake of Gavin Newsom's winning the recall election with Angela Hart. She's a reporter for Kaiser Health News, about the payback that proponents of single-payer health care are going to want for helping Gavin Newsom in California. So you can get that and all of our member content by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. Thank you. So here we are, Heather. It is another week, and in many respects, we're still talking about the same things that we've been talking about for months in some respects. I mean, not in every respect, and so we'll go over it. But as of this week, the end of this week, there is ostensibly a plan between Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell to raise the debt ceiling. And there was a lot of things that took place over the course of this week that I frankly find on one level baffling and another level infuriating. I think those are probably the two emotions that I've had in terms of the way that the Democrats have been dealing with this debt ceiling thing. We know that, well, I think most people will concede this is all a fiction. Right. I mean, I think there was some quote from some Senate meeting that was overheard like on Thursday, you know, somebody saying as they're negotiating this, like saying this is all so stupid. And it is. The whole notion of having to raise the debt ceiling is stupid in and of itself. But we also know it's just sort of this weird fiction where we could mint a coin. People think that's sort of ridiculous, but it also just goes to show you that the whole thing is ridiculous. We're just paying money to ourselves. The Democrats have multiple bites at the reconciliation apple to do this. They have been reluctant to do it. We should talk about that because it has to do with Joe Manchin, I think, and which reconciliation bill they would use. And now they're in this situation where at one point this week, Joe Biden was entertaining carving out something from the filibuster to raise the debt ceiling, which I'm happy about the idea of carving out the filibuster. But when he says that's a real possibility, when we've heard from Democrats time and time again that it's not a possibility when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, when it comes to the PRO Act, when it comes to protecting abortion rights, when it comes to climate change legislation, when it comes to anything that are supposedly huge priorities, I have to wonder, like, what are they thinking?
Well, I mean, you just said a mouthful. It is really hard at this point to kind of, you know, untangle what happened this week and what's going to happen over the next 2 months. Because, well, first of all, there's no untangling the two issues here of the debt ceiling and the big reconciliation bill, certainly from the perspective of the Republicans. I mean, let's just get that out of the way. What their whole point in doing what they did, I mean, for one thing, they've got a whole bunch of people in their caucus who don't want to ever raise the debt ceiling. They think this is some magical thing that's going to, I don't know, rein in spending, that any spending that they don't want to do. I don't know why they think this, particularly since the tax cuts that they just passed and had huge celebrations on the steps of the Capitol just a few years ago. Those were what incurred much of the debt that we have. Massive excessive military spending incurs much of the debt that we have. So this is ridiculous. They are doing this for performative purposes. Okay, fine. That's what they do. But Mitch McConnell knows better. He knows that the consequences of not raising the debt ceiling are extreme. To the U.S. economy, to the world economy, to the entire structure of the financial system with nothing. I mean, you know, and let's just admit, you and I both think maybe there should be some kind of big cataclysm in the world financial system, but not like this, right? I mean, there has to be some way to some plan afoot to supplant it with something better. This is just pure chaos and anarchy, massive human suffering that they're talking about. So Mitch McConnell knows that, but he decided this time that this was a good time to use this issue as it came up at the same time that this reconciliation bill, the infrastructure bill, the funding of the government, which they did get out of the way temporarily. All this coming up at the same time would be a great way to screw up the Democrats' plan. And by doing that, he's leveraging Manchin and Sinema, who we hear this week he was on the horn with over the whole course of the week. You know, I don't know which side they're on here, but it's pretty clear they're not on the side of the Democratic Party, which is opposed to what they're doing 48-2. So, you know, that he feels that this is a good strategy for him to deny Joe Biden a victory and potentially, you know, usher in a Republican majority in 2022. So that's their view. And I don't know that the agreement that they came up with this week, in which they will extend the debt ceiling issue and into December, really does anything to that, unless Manchin and Sinema suddenly come around. They can quickly or reasonably quickly pass this reconciliation bill for the big Build Back Better plan and the infrastructure bill, get that done, and then deal with the debt ceiling. Maybe this will work out in favor of the Democrats, but I don't know that that's how it's going to go. It looks to me like this thing's going to drag out and we'll be back where we were 2 months from now. I hope I'm wrong. And the whole point here is that I think Manchin and Sinema, well, we don't know about Sinema. We can talk about her, but Manchin has been a lot more transparent, at least about what his strategy is. He said, I think we should take a strategic pause. We should wait. There's no rush. Let's not do whatever. So there's no, he doesn't feel a fire under him to get anything done any more than Mitch McConnell does. So I'm not, you know, the fact that he's chattering with Mitch McConnell, you know, through back channels makes me think that they are, you know, I mean, I don't know how you can see any other way, but that they're more or less working together because their goal is the same. So I don't know where that's going to end up. I mean, we're going to have two more months of this Sturm und Drang that we've been going through over it. And maybe something will break. There are ways out of this. You and I have discussed many ways to let Sinema and Manchin have their, you know, victory and be the ones who spared the country, you know, more massive debt or whatever it is they think they need to do. There are ways to do that while preserving the Democratic Party's priorities in this big bill, in the two big bills. But we'll see if they can pull that off. I'm getting less and less sanguine that they are going to be able to do that.
I share your, I don't know if that's pessimism or realism at this point, but my sense is, you know, I've seen some commentary saying, you know, McConnell blinked but frankly, like, I think it's too clever by half. I mean, I think McConnell's agenda here was quite simple: to create chaos, to create a sense of things are not working. Because I think that's all. I don't think when you and I discuss, or when it exists that McConnell's not allowing the filibuster, you know, is maintaining a filibuster against a 50 vote threshold to raise the debt ceiling. And there's going to be a number associated with the debt ceiling as opposed to simply a suspension until a certain amount of time, you know, so that they can pin the Democrats down on a number. I think your average voter, the one who is, you know, now starting to give Joe Biden pretty strong unapproval ratings. I think they just hear the words debt and problem. And that's about it. Like, I don't think anything else. And I think, like, I think it, in Mitch McConnell's world, the idea that people are just hearing debt in the course of a debate about a reconciliation bill. And with, you know, Joe Manchin out there talking about that and them wanting to run, at least, you know, they have to say something, in the midterms, and they're going to be talking about debt, even though I don't think it has any resonance with people. I think like the sort of the knock on impression you have is just general incompetence. Just because, you know, people are trained that way. And I think, you know, McConnell wins, and to extend this for another 2 months is another win. It's like, he's just figured out how to do what he's done for the past 2 weeks for another 2 or 3 weeks that are 4 weeks out. And, you know, Jim Thune this week was saying, like, you know, it's going to be hard for us to get the to get 10 votes from the Republicans, but we're going to work our butts off trying to get it. And it basically just lets McConnell and Thune off as if it's not their strategy. It's just like, you know. It wasn't like we, you know, we planned this out. It's just that our lawmakers, it's really tough to get them on board. We're doing you a big favor here.
Right.
And it's just the Democrats went into this. You and I were talking about this in June, in May. I mean, we all knew this was coming. We knew this was coming a year ago when they passed it. Like, they don't seem to have a plan ever. And I just don't see how this is, you know, and then, but like I say, for Joe Biden to come out and say that we would get rid of the filibuster for this, is he not aware that they have been pretending the filibuster is some type of sacrosanct thing, like literally physically holding up the Senate? How are you going to get, Joe Manchin to vote for a carve out for the debt ceiling? Like, I mean, what, you know, like, I would love it. I would love it. Anything that begins to, but it really, the politics behind all of this just seems like there's nobody at the wheel here.
Well, that's certainly how it looks, right? I mean, that you can't look at the polling. I mean, it's, as you just mentioned it, it's terrible. I mean, one poll has Joe Biden down to a 38% approval rating. And it's all because of that. I mean, look, Biden is fighting a certain sort of archetypal stereotypical sort of thing because he's old, right? And the Republicans have been pushing this and pushing this, but he's not really in charge. He doesn't really know what he's doing. He's really, really, he's shaky. And, you know, the country's in the hands of a man who just is incompetent. That is their, you know, projected vision of him. I don't think that's true. I'm not saying that it's true. I think Biden's probably, he's just in charge as any president is. But that's what they've been saying. So all of this, the chaos, the, you know, the back and forth, the fighting, all that, it just plays right into their narrative, which is that, look, you know, maybe Donald Trump was bad, but, you know, he was strong and he, you know, knew what he wanted and blah, blah, blah. It's all BS, of course, but that is what they're saying. And so this does not help. And 2 more months of this really doesn't help. Now, you know, look, there was one way to deal with this that was the most efficient. You just mentioned it. You get rid of the filibuster. All of this would go away. Every bit of it would go away overnight. They could pass all of their agenda with, I mean, I shouldn't say all of it. They still have to negotiate with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Right. It would be doable. They could actually, I mean, I don't know. They could break up the reconciliation bill and do a bunch of different things and let people vote on that.
And sell each portion of it too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this, they could do all that. The filibuster is what's standing in the way. Now I get it that Joe Manchin doesn't, you know, he's saying absolutely not. I won't do it. Kyrsten Sinema says she won't do it. I just, you know, there has to be a point at which you take the risk that one of these two, I mean, this is the risk that's hanging over this whole thing, right? That one of them will jump parties.
Right.
That happened back in 2001. Jim Jeffords was a Republican and he jumped to the Democrats. And for a short period of time, the Democrats had the majority. And then, you know, and 9/11 happened and you had, you know, the Republicans had a weird midterm victory, right? So everything got kind of, you know, turned around. But the truth is, it does happen. Yeah, people do jump parties. It could happen.
Arlen Specter.
Sure. Arlen Specter jump party. I mean, this happens. Or, you know, Kyrsten Sinema, for instance, I could see her saying, I'm going to become an independent. I just can't live with this. And I will caucus with whomever I want to caucus with. You know, I mean, she could do something crazy like that. And it, whatever happens in a 50-50 Senate, it's dicey. But that's what's hovering all over this, the unwillingness of the Democrats to put the squeeze on Manchin and Sinema to deal with this. You know, okay, you know, take the risk, because if they don't take the risk, everything is gone. They're going to lose in 2 years anyway. They won't have, I mean, this is just, it's an absolute, you know, it's not only historically, you know, sort of predictable, but with what's going on right now, I mean, I would say that it's almost inevitable that they're going to lose in 2022 with this kind of chaotic stuff. So, you know, that this should make, you know, Manchin and Sinema, I mean, this is my view anyway, and I, you know, and I'm sympathetic to it, honestly. They could have change overnight. Suddenly Sinema decides to be an independent, and that's the end of that. You know, you no longer have a Democratic majority. But, you know, Kyrsten Sinema has to run again. She has to, you know, she's a politician. She has big ambitions. She would have to do a big gut check, a big gut check on that. And maybe it's time to make people do that, because look, it's not just this reconciliation bill. I get it. This is huge for the Democratic agenda. It's things that people have wanted for decades, super popular with the country. After all we've been through from both the financial crisis and the pandemic, this economy and our country and all of the sort of things that hold us up as a civilized society are tattered. They are tattered after decades of war, financial instability, and now a pandemic. They have to be fixed, and this has to be done. So I'm not denigrating that in any way. But if they don't get to a point where they can pass some new reforms on our democratic system, on corruption in government, on all this stuff, none of that's going to make any difference. It will be impossible to do anything. And that will never happen with the filibuster in place. It just isn't going to. Joe Manchin is not going to vote for that stuff. And I don't know what, you know, and it can't be done in reconciliation. The filibuster has to be eliminated in order to do this. I don't understand why they haven't just, I mean, Biden saying that the other day was good, came out and said, maybe we need to do that. But he's got to get behind us. And, you know, I realize they're trying to, you know, tiptoe around Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but maybe the time for that is past.
My God, absolutely. All right, we got to take a break. Let's talk, because you wrote a good piece about Kyrsten Sinema this week. I want to talk about that. I also want to talk about the Senate report that came out this week regarding January 6th. There's some, you know, we could see the contours of what was going on in this administration. And this is what, I don't know how else you refer to it other than a coup, frankly. But there was all these attempts. And we're going to take a quick break. We will talk about those. And, of course, also the stay on the Texas abortion law. I think that's a temporary situation. But the real question is, you know, like, why isn't there more energy that is associated on the pro-choice side in light of all this? We'll talk more about that in just a moment. We'll be right back with Heather Parton. So, Heather, we were just talking about the debt ceiling. I think we both share sort of the same feelings that the Democrats didn't seem to enter into this with a plan. And even more problematic in my mind is that to the extent that they had a plan, it seems to have been associated with a goal that is completely, I don't even want to say pyrrhic. I mean, it's just wrongheaded. It just feels like the Democratic leadership is living in some type of parallel universe where the hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell on the debt ceiling convinces anybody of anything. And that ultimately getting Mitch McConnell to help in some way pass a rise on the debt ceiling is anything even remotely close to a victory. I mean, if anything, it is exactly, I mean, I would be shocked if Mitch McConnell didn't say to, you know, his Thune, his, you know, whip in the Senate, like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to play this out for about 30 days. We're going to get as much press as we can to make it seem like everything's in chaos. All the while, say it's the Democrats' responsibility. And then at the last minute, I'm going to, you know, swoop in. Having created all the chaos, I will now be the agent that ends all the chaos. And then we get to do this again in 2 months. I mean, it's not hard to imagine that Mitch McConnell, that was the idea, because that's exactly what Mitch McConnell did. I have no idea what the Democrats thought they could get out of this. Meanwhile, Kyrsten Sinema, she is, I want to say chased into a bathroom, but really somebody walked into the bathroom, following her into the bathroom. They didn't yell at her. They read off a statement, essentially a prepared statement. Same thing happened on a plane. It was so benign on the plane that the stewardess came over and wanted to help the person who had asked the question. Have you gotten all the answers you need? No, I didn't. Well, maybe there's somebody else we can ask. I mean, like, it was pretty benign. But we had a bunch of right wingers come to the rescue of Kyrsten Sinema. What, like, this is just nuts. Like, what is she doing?
Well, it's insane for a number of reasons. I mean, let me just say right up front, I think that following somebody into the bathroom probably was, you know, they could have waited outside the door, I think, rather than go in and stand in front of the stall. To me, that would have been the kinder thing to do. Nonetheless, it was not the end of the world. There were no violent threats. There was nobody saying, you know, I know where you live. You know,
all the things we saw with local politicians and anti-maskers.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, this is the thing that drives me nuts. It's one thing to say, you know, somebody, you know, someone to say, well, gee, that seemed a bit much. For these Republicans to say it, and they have gone into full-blown hissy fit mode over this thing. You know, this is shocking. I'm just, oh, you know, they're clutching their pearls and calling for the smelling salts, the incivility. I can barely stand it. I mean, they are way out there. And for them to do this, number one, let me just say two words. January 6th. I'm sorry, when it comes to, you know, inappropriate protest, they were running through the Capitol screaming, hang Mike Pence. Nobody said that to Kyrsten Sinema, the nice little kids that were standing there with their phones going, you know, we voted for you and we helped get out the vote and we really would like you to listen to us. They weren't saying hang Kyrsten Sinema.
Right.
Furthermore, even worse than that, you had people like, I think it was Charles Cook in the National Review saying, just imagine if a Republican had done something like this. You don't have to imagine it.
Right.
Because they did it. They chased Mitt Romney through the airport, screaming in his face, traitor, traitor. They got on the plane and chanted it on the airplane. Traitor, traitor, screaming at him to resign. Lindsey Graham, they chased him through it. That was just before January 6th. Just after January 6th, they chased Lindsey Graham through an airport. I mean, and nobody's more loyal to their dear leader than he is. They chased him, and the security guards had to come and rescue him because they were coming in so close on him. Anthony Gonzalez, the guy from Ohio, the Republican congressman who decided not to run again, a future star of the GOP until he voted for impeachment, he said that the reason that he decided not to run is because he and his family, when they go to the airport, have to be escorted by police because wow. They're being harassed by people. Now, those are other GOP senators and congressmen being harassed by Republicans. Okay. Exactly the same situation, far more violent, far more threatening than anything that happened to poor Kyrsten Sinema. They didn't say a word about that. And then it's what you said, that all over the country, healthcare workers, election officials, school boards are being violently harassed. People are coming to their homes. They're threatening their kids. I saw a thing here in LA. Just the other day, where somebody was chasing kids down the sidewalk who were wearing masks.
Yes.
At them about mask wearing. This is the kind of stuff that's happening all over the country at the hands of Republican protesters. They're not just going after elected officials and saying we don't like what you're doing in Washington. They are going after local officials and local citizens, just people and little kids going to school. So let's not hear any more from Republicans on this. I don't want to hear it. This is ridiculous. And anybody who gives them a platform to, you know, clutch their pearls. over this Kyrsten Sinema thing is just, it's insane. They should never do it without doing a full, you know, a complete, you know, documented evidence of all the things that the Republicans are doing. It's infuriating.
Right. And again, I mean, I am of the opinion that, you know, you should have access to your politicians, and
it's in the Constitution.
But there's also, I mean, I am of the mind that, like, there's a difference between when you have someone reading a statement that is clearly, you know, people can disagree. Maybe, you know, immigrants who have been in this country for years and years, decade or more, brought here as children, maybe they don't need protection. People could have that opinion. But when someone is sitting there reading off a prepared statement that anybody listening would know is coherent, this is not like, you know, I've got transistors that they're putting in cars outside my window and I have to keep my window shut so that I'm not, you know, I mean, this is not one of those type of situations. This is, and anybody can tell that these people are coherent, that they're in control, that they are, you know, reading off a statement. It's a political protest. This is not, there's no, you know, any type of like insinuation of potential violence. The woman was on the plane. She walked down the center aisle, asked a question of Kyrsten Sinema for, I don't know, 2 minutes. I mean, I think if there's going to be an assessment of the behavior, then the behavior should be really contextualized and seen as like, this wasn't that bad. I mean, I do think it's possible to get up in front of, like, you know, politicians, and we shouldn't be scaring them. There shouldn't be this sort of like overt, like, you know, or subtle or subtextual physical threat. But I don't see how you look at any of that stuff and think there was. On top of which, you know, like you say, this is not, based upon what we've seen over the years, this is not outside of the box, even, you know, whether you do, you view it in context or out of context, it is not out of the box. And God knows what Kyrsten Sinema is doing. We have no more clue, I think, today than we did last week, frankly. All right, we have two other things that were sort of a big deal. One is a report coming out of the Senate Judiciary that appears to show Donald Trump had promised a guy in the Department of Justice, if you lean on this and get this investigation going in Georgia, I'll make you acting attorney general, or at least you can use that threat. I mean, that's pretty stunning stuff. We just got about a minute left, but what should Democrats do with that at this point?
Gosh, you know, I mean, I don't know. It is shocking. Even though we, as you said earlier, we knew the contours of this, but the details are really, really stunning. I mean, the White House counsel went to the president and said, if you do this, if you replace the acting attorney general with your guy, Clark, it's a murder-suicide pact, just meaning by that, that everybody was going to resign, including his own people, members of the Department of Justice. And in fact, in the report, it says they were packing up their stuff at the Department of Justice. That's how close this got. And, you know, the details are really stunning. People should read this report. It's very easy to read. It's a, you know, it's a good, you know, outline with a lot of detail in it. This was a coup plot. And the Republicans are now saying here, Brit Hume and Chuck Grassley, they're coming out and saying, well, hey, yeah, it's bad that he did that, but they wouldn't go along with it. So really, what's the big deal? I mean, this is astonishing that anybody would say that his plot to do this was, you know, wasn't the greatest thing in the world, but hey, it could have been worse. I mean, this is completely outrageous. I don't know what they can do about it. Look, Robert Mueller left a report that had 10 instances of obstruction of justice in which he explicitly said, this can be, you know, you can take legal action against this president when he leaves office on all of these things. It's all laid out there. Here's more. There's a ton of stuff there. This guy broke the law, intended to break the law, tried to subvert our democracy, overturn an election. There are legal means to do something about that. But, you know, do you think you're going to? Because I sure don't.
Well, Heather, we can check in on that next week because we're out of time today. Heather Parton, as always, a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
As a part of the mass reflection that I think a lot of us on the left have been doing on the 10th anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, there's been a focus on how Occupy spread globally, but that global focus is often confined to specific parts of the globe. The Western left is not immune from being privy to existing societal biases or repeating them. And the lack of coverage of Africa is a part of it, including the lack of coverage of the largest Occupy movement in the world at the time, Occupy Nigeria. Here to talk about this is Zachariah Mampilly, Marx Chair of International Affairs at the Marx School of Public and International Affairs at CUNY, whose piece on this topic in Dissent magazine is entitled "Why Did the Western Left Ignore Occupy Nigeria?" Welcome to the show, Zachariah.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So, you know, your piece is really, and this is a part of my own biases as well, the only thing I've seen that I can remember written about Occupy Nigeria. So I guess we should start there talking about that movement. Tell us a little bit about how massive that was and how important that was in the larger context of Occupy and in the context of, I guess, general leftist movements internationally.
Sure. So shortly after New Year's Day in 2012, the Nigerian government removed the fuel subsidies that keep the price of oil very low in an oil-producing country. And they did this intentionally because most people were at home for the holidays and returned to their local villages, and they were trying to hold off any sort of large uprising on the streets. And so they were trying to do it at a point where they knew people had left to the big cities. And this immediately caused a major crisis in the country. People were stranded at home. They weren't able to return to their places of work. And pretty quickly, people started taking to the streets and challenging, not only the fuel price hike, but also the general state of misgovernance that has characterized that country for quite some time now. And it eventually swelled into some of the largest protests in Nigerian history. And as you already mentioned, the largest Occupy protests in the world, eventually taking on the name of Occupy Nigeria and spreading throughout the country to both small and big cities, as well as to rural areas in all parts of the country.
And what was the result of those mass protests? What did it create? What was the blowback, for example?
Well, so unfortunately, the protests it reached their maximum scale in about 2 weeks, at which point a number of the organizers, especially the Nigerian union movement, began backdoor negotiations with the government under the threat of a military intervention. If you remember, this was a time when there was a lot of concern about Boko Haram and other armed groups. And the Nigerian government started to claim that they were going to deploy the military to prevent the protests from being attacked by Boko Haram. And that led to a very rapid collapse of the protest movement itself. The government did reinstate some of the subsidies, but ultimately the new price of oil was made permanent. I think in terms of its actual impact and legacy, as you know, a couple of years ago, there was another upsurge of protests in Nigeria, this time around police brutality, what's known as the NSARS protest. And so you see that the Nigerian population is very much primed for these sorts of revolutionary actions. It's not quite clear whether or not they'll be able to, fulfill their ambitions of really bringing about a major transformation of Nigerian politics and economics. But there's no doubt that Nigeria remains a very restive place and that there are popular movements ready to rise again in the aftermath of Occupy and more recently the NSARS movement.
It's interesting because often when at least the American left or the Western left discusses fertile ground for uprisings of this nature, it's within the context of the Arab Spring. You point this out in your piece that there is a bit of a blind spot or an over-focus on Northern Africa, and it's portrayed as distinct from other parts of Africa. And I understand, I'm talking a little bit more about the Middle East in terms of the way that the left portrays it, but you don't necessarily hear about Nigeria as a place where there's fertile ground for these kinds of uprising, I guess, in any mainstream source, and even in leftist sources, it's not necessarily discussed there.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, I think there, you know, remains even amongst the left some blind spots when it comes to Africa. Certainly, I think the question of race and racism plays a role here. But I think there's also a more specific kind of blind spot related to Africa, in that Africa is always sort of assumed to be too rural, a continent filled with villagers who are incapable of meaningful political action, too ethnic. You know, the question of tribe and ethnicity is always put at the center of our analyses. And so we don't think of African countries through a lens of class, for example. Too poor, right? We tend to assume that being a part of a popular movement requires some sort of leadership from a highly educated class, and our assumptions about Africa being a place where people are not educated continue to shape our ability to engage with the movements that are actually proliferating around the continent. And then, you know, I think on the question of the Arab Spring, I mean, one of the most extraordinary things is that, you know, the Arab Spring mostly unfolded in Africa, and there was this sort of consistent tendency to treat the politics of countries like Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, others that, you know, are literally located in Africa as somehow being a part of something different. And that, again, reflects these sort of longstanding colonial biases that really tried to partition the northern part of the continent from the rest of the continent in ways that don't actually make much political sense.
Right. And do you think that that partitioning was also reinforced by the Western approach to, say, like the war on terror and the modern colonial elements of that, right? There's a way that I think the Western left is unable sometimes to see political movements outside of the lens of U.S. colonialism, which is helpful in some ways, but then it creates blind spots in others.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the more interesting things about the war on terror is the ways in which it has really spread to the African continent. So even as we see the U.S. pull out from Afghanistan, there has been no sort of corresponding drawdown from countries like Somalia, other parts of the Sahel, the region of West Africa that borders the Sahara, where the U.S. presence has dramatically increased over the past two decades, all in the name of fighting terrorism in those countries. And I think that reflects a kind of longer standing bias where, you know, when the U.S. intervenes in places like Afghanistan or Iran or other parts of North Africa, there's a way in which we think of those as political interventions and hence a part of this larger apparatus of U.S. imperialism globally. But when they intervene in places like Somalia or, you know, say, Nigeria or other countries in Africa where we have a presence, we tend to frame it through a humanitarian lens. And so even amongst the left, we tend to understand those interventions as somehow distinct from other interventions that we may be more critical of. Somehow they are thought to be, you know, done in the interest of saving Africans rather than as part of these complex geopolitical calculations that the United States is always making when we engage with any other country in the world.
Right. And the concept of humanitarianism and how that's deployed is endlessly fascinating and depressing to me because it's about centering yourself as the savior. And that's I think, is a way to still make yourself prominent, or, you know, I guess even as state actors, and not elevating the voices that you pretend that you're saving, for example.
I think that's absolutely, you know, the tragedy of humanitarianism is precisely the way in which we treat it as an apolitical space, right? To tend to think that this reflects our own innate moral values or our desire to do good in the world rather than as part of a complex political process, a complex political intervention into these other societies, often carried out without any input, as you point out, from the societies themselves. And this has a long history. I mean, I think there are a lot of African scholars. I'm teaching a class today where we read a piece by Feroz Manji, who's a Kenyan scholar, and the piece is called The Missionary Position. And he actually sort of traces the origins of humanitarian organizations back to European colonial enterprises and the need for colonial empires to have this sort of charity wing of imperial domination. And I think that's a much more productive lens through which we should understand the prevalence of humanitarian organizations in many parts of Africa today.
Well, and then it's also like charity and humanitarian work in the United States now serves a double function. One, you can center yourself internationally, and then here you can use it as a way to avoid taxes and advocating for policies where you can choose and cherry pick which pet organizations reflect yourself in the way that you want to be, and not giving it to the government where it could be more adequately distributed, for example. Like, I guess I know this wasn't really in your piece, but I am curious if you could expand a little bit on the approach of Westerners when it comes to humanitarianism in Africa and seeing it as that apolitical space, which is obviously inaccurate. But there's racism there, of course. And also, I think I'm not even sure how to identify it. I'm going to ask you to, like, what are some of the dynamics you see in the way that, like, humanitarianism in the continent of Africa is deployed in some of these, like, more elite and even academic spaces in the United States?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. I'll try to condense my answer to just a couple of minutes. But, you know, I think there's a long history of critical scholarship on the question of humanitarianism and its interrelationships with U.S. strategic objectives abroad, especially on the African continent. You know, I think one way to think about it that may make it a little easier is, you know, we have arrived at a point now in the United States where we do have a much clearer understanding of how, you know, billionaires use philanthropy as a way to avoid paying taxes, right? And that's a much more, I think, holistic understanding of the role that charity and humanitarianism plays within the larger kind of infrastructure of global capitalism. Yet when it comes to kind of extending those insights to the African continent, we often don't apply the same kind of critical analysis. And so that we tend to view, you know, humanitarianism and other types of foreign intervention as inherently a benevolent activity, as something that, you know, even if we may not like the kind of tenor of it or, you know, the visual manifestations of it, you know, you can imagine like the young white woman posting pictures of working in an orphanage, that will generate a lot of outrage on Twitter. But, you know, I think that we don't take that analysis further to look at sort of the structural role that humanitarian aid plays in advancing American foreign policy in particular. And this is something that is not subtle, right? So under the Obama administration, the administrator of USAID at the time, a man named Raj Patel, who is now the head of a major U.S. foundation, you know, he basically announced that going forward, USAID would try to link all of its programming more directly to serve American security interests, right? And it was taken as a logical conclusion.
Ah, yes.
USAID should function in ways that obviously I find to be hugely problematic, and I wish many more on the left were more critical of.
I think, you know, I mean, this is so off topic, but we're seeing some of this dynamic with the vaccine inequities in the across the globe, where the Biden administration is benevolently donating billions of doses when, of course, waiving IP protections, waiving these patents would immediately provide access to vaccines for a lot of these poorer nations. But you'd rather use it as a tool of American hegemony than do what is expedient and helpful, and also protect corporate interests in vaccine production for big pharma. It's kind of just like and it's also affected the continent of Africa. I mean, I read today a statistic that 70% of African countries were unable to meet the WHO's goal of 10% for a vaccinated population by this date. And so, like, that also is just a numerical indicator of how insufficient this kind of humanitarian approach to the continent of Africa is from the West.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there is a very long tendency, as I've been trying to emphasize, of viewing Africa through the lens of American moral ambitions, right? And it's a tendency that tends to stretch across both Republican and Democratic administrations. You know, in the midst of the war on terror, George Bush, you know, really tried to pivot towards Africa in terms of using African countries and American foreign policy towards Africa to kind of challenge the harsh criticism that was being leveled against the war on terror in other spaces. Obama did much the same. You know, it was this kind of combination of contempt and neglect mixed with these sort of broad promises of bringing freedom and democracy and development to the continent. And so this is a fairly long-standing tradition in American foreign policy that bridges the Republican and the Democratic Party. And I think it's something that we're seeing very clearly with the question of COVID vaccines as well. I mean, the U.S. has done a really horrible job. The international community has really done a horrible job in terms of providing access to African countries to produce their own vaccines, to vaccinate their own populations, and is instead, again, reverting back to this idea that somehow we are doing them a favor rather than it being an obligation, a moral obligation on behalf of humanity, and one that would serve our own interests as much as anyone else's.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to dive into a little bit of the political differences in some of the nations in Africa that also cause some blind spots on the left. For example, neoliberal left movements versus socialist movements, and what that means for how the left approaches things. We'll be right back. So one of the things that you pointed out in your piece, which I hadn't really considered in terms of the way that the global north and or the West approaches Africa or and movements and leftist movements and publications in those countries, is that there isn't necessarily a Marxist or anti-capitalist movement to the degree that you see, like, say, in terms of successes in Latin America, in South America or in Bolivia, for example, or in different areas, or with Lula in Brazil. It's just a different approach. And do you believe that that is part of the reason that the American left doesn't portray African countries as political or see them in the same way because they're more in a neoliberal space?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's useful to just take a quick visit to the history. And you know, there is a version of Africa that remains very prevalent in the American and I would say the global left imagination. And that was, you know, the period of the anti-colonial struggles in the 1950s and 1960s, and a number of the regimes that came out of that period. So if you think about Tanzania under Julius Nyerere, or Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, or, you know, Algeria under Ben Bella, you know, there was a number of these regimes that were kind of darlings of a global socialist imaginary. And I think many of those figures remain quite prominent within left circles today. And I think they were doing some really interesting things at the time. But there's also a problem with kind of romanticizing that era while neglecting the actual politics that are ongoing in many African countries today, right? And so as much as we want to kind of elevate and romanticize, you know, those figures, it often leads to an inclusion of what's actually happening in many countries across the continent right now. And I think part of the problem is, you know, what I tried to address in the piece, you know, is that many African governments is fundamentally neoliberal in their orientation, right? We don't have, as you already mentioned, a Lula or other kinds of governments, you know, that are sympathetic to kind of critiquing neoliberalism. And this has a particular history. So the last major wave of African protests was in the 1980s and 90s. And those were protests explicitly driven by structural adjustment programs, right? They were protests against the austerity agenda. And they were huge and they were significant. And they, by and large, failed to change the political scenarios that we saw in many African countries. And so this is a period in which neoliberalism really cements its hold across African governments, so much so that, you know, even parties like the African National Congress, which even today is still a part of the Socialist International, embraces a fundamentally neoliberal agenda upon coming to power in the early 1990s. Right. And so really across the African political landscape, you don't see left parties in government or even contesting for power within any of these states. Right. And so to me, I think that actually makes the task for the left outside of Africa even more pressing. Right? We have to actually pay attention to the actual movements that exist and try to understand what role they have. And I think one of the key things that we are seeing is first that they're not adhering to kind of traditional conceptions of Marxist struggle that we may prefer to see and that you can see in places like Latin America, in places like Southeast Asia. And second, I think very importantly, you know, they aren't necessarily as caught up in the question of capturing state power, right? They are movements that are seemingly advancing much more modest goals. They're calling for objectives that are a little bit less clear cut. You know, they're not as hostile or ideological towards capitalism. You know, they often are calling for more equitable distribution of resources rather than fundamental transformation to a socialist economy. And these make it more challenging for those of us outside of the continent to really sort of slot them into our pre-existing frameworks. But that's not an excuse for our ignorance, right? I think that the conclusion should not be that therefore there aren't any movements interesting going on the continent, but precisely the opposite, that many of the movements now are dealing with the same sort of challenges that the left is facing around the world in a context in which neoliberalism seems to be the dominant and sole mode of organizing societies around the world. You know, I think left movements have struggled to figure out what alternatives can be. And I think African movements in particular have been dealing with the kinds of challenges of like austerity and structural adjustment for three decades now, so that they are also kind of further along in these conversations than even movements in North America or Western Europe.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned the ANC, and I want to talk a little bit more about South Africa in a little bit. But I mean, it also then peels back another layer, these blind spots and like the inability to understand some of these more complex gradations of racism here and blind spots, because for years and years, the United States did not have a massive leftist movement that was calling for socialism. I mean, the Bernie Sanders campaign and in the wake of Occupy, things changed, but neoliberal austerity was the go-to in the United States, was the go-to in the UK for a while, as is still the go-to in Germany, for example, although they were just dealt a massive blow, and their left is emerging a little bit too. But you didn't see the blind spots about the left in those countries, even though their journey towards Marxist leftism or socialism was not as fruitful as it is now, or not as burgeoning as it is now, which is, I think, interesting, right? It's just like that's where many African countries are now. They're just in a different spot in terms of the fertile ground for leftism.
Yeah, I think so. I think there is a reality that the left around the world has to confront, and that is that, you know, we are living through an unprecedented, you know, consolidation of a capitalist global order, right? I think even the fact that China, you know, we can have debates around what China is doing internally, but externally seems to have fully embraced a capitalist model. That's the approach that they certainly are using in their negotiations with African countries, where China is, you know, the largest trade partner with most of these countries, and by and large is focused on extracting the maximum number of resources from each of these countries, often using the mechanism of debt to put these countries into long-standing obligations to the Chinese government, viewing Africa essentially as a site for the extraction of commodities and the sale of products produced in China. You know, it makes for a really kind of bleak landscape, I think, for global left struggles. But that is not to say that there aren't opportunities for thinking new, right? I think that's precisely why I find it so interesting, you know, as somebody who doesn't have roots on the continent, to pay attention to what's happening in the African context, precisely because those are the peoples who've been most impacted by global capitalism and for the longest period of time. The kinds of conversations and debates that movements across Africa are having, I think, are far more advanced than what we're seeing in the United States, which, as you point out, is fairly new to the concept of alternatives to capitalism. Right? That's not a discourse that was very common until really the past 10 years. That is one of the great legacies of Occupy Wall Street. But I think there's a hubris inherent in that, too, wherein we think, well, we created Occupy Wall Street. Therefore, once again, the United States can teach the rest of the world on how we should take inequality seriously. Right? Whereas many other parts of the world have been dealing with that much more directly and actually have much more sophisticated analyses that could probably inform our own struggles here in the United States.
Yeah, I was having a discussion today on the concept of like white feminism as an extension of capitalism. And there's a lot of shadings in what you're saying here, just because of like, you know, a dominant power telling another nation or another culture, you know, what's right. And it's really just an extension of one's own narcissism and these power dynamics. But I digress. I wanted to talk a little bit about South Africa, because the last time, I think, outside of, you know, in the mid-2000s, a lot of celebrities wearing Save Darfur t-shirts. I don't want to, you know, forget about that pivotal moment in history. But, of course, South Africa, what I think was one of the only times, you know, in recent history that the United States engaged in a way and, like, the public engaged in a political way with the continent of Africa was during apartheid. And there was a recognition there, and the left did have a response in this country. Something similar we're seeing to the way that, of course, Israel's apartheid state in with Palestine is being responded to in this country. But I mean, I guess I'm just curious about your take on that historically and what that meant to have the global north, the United States in particular, some leftist movement in protesting what was happening in South Africa with apartheid, and what that means in the broader context of some of these blind spots you've been fleshing out here.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's useful to look at the history of the anti-apartheid struggle in the U.S. and what that did for the South African movement, but also what it did for the United States, right? I think, you know, the benefits of solidarity are not unidirectional. That's one of the beauties of looking globally for allies, right? For alliances that can help us in these larger struggles that we face, because they are global struggles. And I think much of what has happened in the United States over the past couple of decades has been this kind of movement inward, wherein even progressive movements no longer tend to think of themselves as being a part of a global community, but are much more particularistic in their focus. Right. If we go back to the South African case, I mean, you know, the call for involvement of Americans and people on the left in particular to support the anti-apartheid struggle started with the recognition of the unique power that the United States continues to wield over the political and economic system at the global level, right? And it was really a call that emanated from within South African civil society, from within radical elements within South Africa, basically saying that, you know, your government is propping up the apartheid state in South Africa, and we need you to take the struggle not only, you know, to support the struggle in South Africa, but to take the struggle to Washington, D.C. as well. And that really galvanized, I think, an entire generation of people of color in particular, who created all kinds of formations. These were not just lobbying groups in D.C., but, you know, study groups, chapter-based organizations around the country that really mobilized a large segment of the population to be concerned about a foreign policy issue. That's something that rarely happens in the United States, right? And it's very important, I think, you know, to bring people of all sorts into foreign policy decision-making, because the U.S. government remains so powerful in shaping the international order. And so to me, you know, looking back at the 1980s and 1990s, the sort of high point of the anti-apartheid struggle in the United States, that was really an exceptional moment in American foreign policy, because it was probably the largest mass mobilization of individuals advocating around a specific issue in contravention of the U.S. government position. Right?
And it's also
effective.
Yeah, and it was a way, we'll wrap up in a second, I apologize, but I'm curious if you agree that it was more digestible for people in the same way when you frame Israel-Palestine as like a systemic racism problem and a segregation problem. American leftists can look at that from their own historical lens and understanding the Jim Crow South. In a way that I think is maybe why some of those movements, and I'm still hoping Israel-Palestine has more salience, but that it can create that kind of reaction.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's an unfortunate tendency where sometimes.
So now we're back to being cynical about people's perspectives, but I think that's part of it, right?
I mean, I hope that we can, you know, ideally the question of identity can be understood from a multidimensional perspective. We don't have to separate out our identities as women, as people of color, or anything else from the material question of class, right? I think there's been a whole longstanding tradition of Black feminists insisting on the intersections of between class and other identities. And then sometimes we forget that, right? We take the question of class and bracket it and assume that identities alone are sufficient basis for generating popular movements. And I feel like our recent struggles on the left have too often kind of decentered the role of class, not to the exclusion of these identities, but rather as understanding them as mutually constituted. And I think we need to get back to that tradition of trying to have a holistic understanding of the ways in which our identities actually allow us to build alliances rather than building walls.
Absolutely. Well, Zachariah Mampilly, Marx Chair of International Affairs at the Marx School of Public and International Affairs at CUNY. You can read his piece in Dissent magazine, Why Did the Western Left Ignore Occupy Nigeria? This was a great discussion, Zachariah. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on.
Hey, folks, that's our show today. Thanks so much for joining us. On behalf of Emma Vigeland, I want to say thank you to Heather Parton, and thank you to you for joining us. And a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can support the free show, you can become a member, and you can get extra content over at rofpodcast.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We will see you, hear you, talk to you again next week.